The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. Today, we're talking about a new thriller, The President is Missing, written in tandem by James Patterson and Bill Clinton. James Patterson is a prolific American author known for writing across various genres. His books have sold over 350 million copies worldwide. He's especially famous for his crime series featuring characters such as Alex Cross and Michael Bennett. Patterson's also well-versed in the act of collaboration, having co-written most of his books with multiple authors. Bill Clinton. Well, we all know who Bill Clinton is, the 42nd President of the United States, who served for two terms after being elected in 1992. Though he's written four non-fiction titles in the past, The President is Missing is his first foray into the world of the novel. To assess whether this literary power couple have come up with the goods in The President is Missing, I'll be joined in the studio today by the journalist Sarah Shaffy and senior programmer for literature and spoken word at the South Bank Centre, that is Ted Hodgkinson. In The President is Missing, then, the President of the United States is Jonathan Duncan, a former war hero. He's currently trying to prevent a huge cyber attack on his country by the terrorist organisation the Sons of Jihad and their leader Suleiman Sinduruk. This all takes place while Duncan's potential impeachment looms in the very near future. Can he save the world and his job? Well, in just 513 pages, you will have the pleasure of finding out. Ted and Sarah, welcome to the programme. There's only 513 pages of our lives. Across the three of us, I mean, that's a sort of 1,700-odd pages that we've kind of got through by yesterday evening, I suppose, at least in my case. Mm. Does this collaboration work, Sarah?
No, not really. I think when you have a book that long, it really has to earn its page count.
Yeah.
And I don't think this did. I don't think the pacing earned it. I don't think the characters earned it. I don't think the plotting really earned it, if I'm honest.
There is a quote, I think it's Jeffrey Deaver on the back of the book, says that it is James Patterson's relentless plotting. Relentless is kind of the word, isn't it, Ted? There's a lot of all sorts of things, not all of it maybe that good going on in this book, but it got us to the end very quickly somehow, despite its length.
We did arrive at the end quickly. I certainly did. I suppose that one of the things you're increasingly told in this book is that everything is high stakes, even though the plot doesn't necessarily follow, is that actually every encounter that they're having is somehow in lockdown. There's great seriousness attached to everything. And yet the plot takes quite a few turns. There's a cul-de-sac here or there. There are moments where, I mean, and actually one of the crescendos of the book, it just, without giving too much away, just involves lots of people entering passwords, which feels like something which is very common to a lot of us when we've forgotten our passwords. But actually, it didn't feel like that it was quite earned as the kind of dramatic climax of this novel.
I agree. I think that's the problem in that nothing really happens for the first 100 or so pages. And then you're kind of, you're promised, oh, we'll tell you about this, we'll tell you about this, we'll tell you about this. But whenever that thing comes round, it's never as exciting as it should be. And actually, you've probably guessed what's going on. I mean, it's fairly predictable in parts.
There is a funny thing, you're absolutely right, Ted. It's a very amusing thing where kind of one of the, as you say, it nears the end, we're only sort of 40 pages from the end or something, and they're in a sort of place that's a bit like Camp David, although it's owned by a sort of private benefactor, I guess, of the of the Duncan administration. He's an old mate of President Duncan's, isn't he? Anyway, and you're right, it has a dramatic tension of essentially a conversation that everyone has in their houses when they're booking a holiday, going, darling, do you know the EasyJet password? Do you know the...
Is it lower uppercase or uppercase, and yeah. actually get into
Have
that.
We spelled it with an O or with a U? Like,
there is, yeah, there is a weird thing. I mean, one of the things, I guess, which was promised by this collaboration is not only the fact that James Patterson is by a long chalk the world's most successful novelist in terms of the money he's made and his sales and all the rest of it, but what was quoted as Clinton's sort of the unparalleled access to matters of state, matters of kind of geopolitics, all the things that Bill Clinton would bring to it. Did either of you sense that? Were there moments in the book where you go into a certain room in the White House or you go into a certain sort of secret bunker that made you kind of feel convinced of this sort of special access that Clinton gave?
So I love a political story set in the White House or in an American administration.
Yeah.
And I don't honestly feel like I learn that much new stuff, really,
yeah.
because we're not in the White House for any of the... I mean, we're in the White House for 30 pages or so, I think, at the beginning.
Mm.
And then there's nothing really that surprising. There was one moment where they're at this Camp David-like place and some people turn up. And I was like, oh, okay, that can happen.
Yeah.
But apart from that, there was nothing really insightful. You can see Bill Clinton in the book, I think. It's a book for kind of policy wonks, people who love like the ins and outs
yeah.
and the kind of the minutiae of how you go before a select committee or whatever it
yeah.
might be. But I don't think there's any surprising revelations.
I agree, but I think that one of the things that's interesting is the president in this novel is a sort of composite figure who's partly Clinton. I feel like there's a touch of John McCain about him as well in his veteranhood.
Yeah.
There's also, for me, I couldn't stop thinking of Harrison Ford in
I couldn't stop thinking of Harrison Ford, actually.
That kind yeah. of, that sort of like manly president who takes matters into his own hands. He bleeds red, white and blue. You know, he is patriotism to the core. He is, it reminded me of something that Kingsley Amis said about the James Bond novels, that they are fantasy that has been technologized.
Yeah.
You know, and that this is really a technological fairy tale in which the president is the hero of that fairy tale. And Clinton is present in the book. And actually, there are a couple of moments, as Sarah says, there are these moments of policy which sometimes do appear kind of slightly undigested chunks of this is what he thinks about social media.
That moment of kind of clearly talking about President Trump and his kind of use of social media versus, I guess, Hillary and Bill and the way they might use social media. And
I was sort of reminded during these bits of sort of politicking in it. Suddenly you get sort of a good solid page or page and a half of this is what America should be doing in the world, and this is the importance of NATO, this is the importance of the office of the president. So we were suddenly sort of stuck in the middle of a chapter, and that felt sort of Clinton-ish. But it reminded me of all those bits in Austin Powers where Basil Exposition pops up and goes, well, what's going to happen next, chaps, is this on Austin Powers' little sort of video screen in his E-Type. And it reminded me of that. It's kind of really hilarious, these bits of... And don't forget that this is a serious book, by the way.
But I think that it shows his hand in a sense, because at that point you see that one of the things that's driving this collaboration is that Clinton, there's a message that he wants to deliver and he wants to impart that, and I think possibly sees this the vehicle of the thriller as a way to get people's attention and then say, this is very important, we need freedom of the press. You know, there are moments like that in the novel that pop up. I think some of the most telling things about White House access are some of the most everyday details. There's a moment where the president says that he hasn't shut a car door for years.
Yeah.
And actually, I thought
that's quite good.
Yeah. And in a way, that does tell you something about the experience of being president, which perhaps Bill Clinton, you know, would be in a position to say that other writers, certainly James Patterson, might not have picked up on. But I think that the problem as a whole, though, is that there's this valorization of the role to such a degree that he doesn't really have a hinterland as a character. He's really just, he is patriotism. He is the best of every part of America. And I think that's only interesting to a point.
Mm. Yeah. He's so pure that it makes it hard for you to be invested in what's going to happen, because you know it's going to be fine. You know a character that is this good cannot possibly fail. And I think that's a real problem in the story, and that goes back to kind of where we're saying, I think the tensions don't really come through because there just isn't any, really.
And there's a scene where he kind of goes and walks the streets of Washington when he's supposed to be going to this baseball game. He goes in disguise, by the way, which also, there are certain parts of the book where I was reading bits of it out to my wife at the weekend and kind of going, I couldn't stop kind of doing it in the Team America voice, you know, sort of like where they're sort of dressed up as awful racist stereotypes in disguise, you know, and walking around Afghanistan and Iraq sort of doing awful, heinous acts of sort of imperial kind of terrorism in these awful sort of Arabic disguises, you know, or Arab disguises. And it just seemed, huge parts of it seemed a lot like that somehow.
It's that moment where he goes, so his, because another thing is in the book, he's a widower and he is still very much in love with her. He's completely, almost in a way, you know, sexless. There's nothing about him that's kind of controversial in that way. And there's this moment where he goes to see a friend of his wife's, and all she does is like shape his eyebrows, and I thought that's such a ridiculous kind of, and then he's, you know, you spend two pages hearing about eyebrows, and then he looks in the mirror and says, I never realised how much, you know, changing your eyebrow shape could change your face. And I just thought,
but she's also, this friend of his wife's is also a major Hollywood actress, and one that was voted by Esquire magazine
as,
she was voted to be one of the 10 best looking women in the world by GQ or something that year. But he felt no, there was no, he felt no attraction. He felt no attraction.
This is one of the funny things about the novel, is that it sort of denies its own impulses as a thriller. Like that scene when he comes in and she's she's introduced to us quite early on as one of the most beautiful women in the world. Yeah. You think that this will be a moment where he allows his grief for his wife.
He's not saying that. It's the readers of GQ magazine.
Right. But also similarly, there's a killer, the assassin in the book, who's also extremely beautiful, who's described, I mean, very much as a sort of page three girl, you know, it's that level of description.
Yeah.
I think her breasts are referred to at one point as the girls.
Yeah.
Yes.
And actually, she is someone who is introduced to us in a highly sexualized way, but then the later in the book, the authors sort of chastise us for thinking about sex in relation to her. You know, that actually sex has nothing to do with her. It's not to do with her life. And I think, I mean, this is one of the problems you mentioned about him being a bit bloodless as a character, the president. One of the moments that really stuck out for me was in the Situation Room moment when there's been that attack and it's gone wrong. And he says, I'm sorry for his loss, but I don't have time to be sorry. I have to keep my eye on the prize. I have 300 million people to protect.
Yeah.
And there's no moment there of any character emerging. It's just, that's his objective. And I think the point really is that he is, at the time when perhaps the presidency, perhaps Bill Clinton feels, is a bit imperiled, I think that this is a version of the president which is the total embodiment of loyalty, virtue. And so sex and the sort of darker sides of that character have been swept away to present this.
So we've had a giggle, and we will probably continue to do so over it. But were there moments in the book that kind of got your kind of juices running a little bit and kind of made you kind of hurry on through? There were bits in it, about a quarter of the way through or half the way through, I was kind of like, this, here we go. And I think I was only tripped up when it turned out that there was a timer thing on the password, as well as just a password. There was a timer on it. It was like the dual, it was like the double cliche.
There's actually a buffering line as well, isn't there? It's loading at one point.
There are two illustrations where you see the percentage loading. I have to be honest, I think the moments that most interested me were actually outside of the main plot of this cyber attack. And there's a moment when you see the vice president meeting with somebody else, and there's something quite shady going on. And I thought, that's interesting. That's a real tension there, and a real threat to the presidency in a way that perhaps you don't expect. And so I was more interested in that kind of thing, but you only got very brief.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like that as well. I thought that was going somewhere, and that was quite, that was something about, you know, when a president or someone in a position of power is being kind of, you know, politicked by, you know, is being, there's the attempt at the impeachment, and there's all that sort of stuff. I thought that was quite interesting, and had a degree of subtlety that nothing else in the book had. And there were actually a couple of things where you wanted to read the sentence twice to go, okay, so what happens if he meets this person, which you never got elsewhere in the thing, where every chapter is every sentence is just a one-liner. And and also lots of sentences. Sometimes paragraphs are only two sentences long and stuff. So there is a kind of unbelievable, it's like being shot out of a rocket with that helmet on, a lot of the book, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think what Ted said of that line earlier about not having time to worry about the death of a certain person, I think what you see quite a lot of is just this forward momentum, this kind of like, this is what we must do and it's all for the good of the country. And he keeps wanting to take the politics out of things. And at the end of the day, he is a president. That is a political role. And so when he takes the politics out of things, that makes things less exciting, I think, if we're looking at this as a thriller.
I agree. I actually thought some of the most gripping bits of the book were the moments where Bill Clinton, I think, breaks the frame and actually does deliver some of his views. And actually, there's a little bit of a critique in the novel as well about... There's a line that stood out to me, which is in the narrative. This isn't quoted dialogue, where he says, "But that contradiction is quintessentially American, typical of a nation that was built on the premise of freedom, equality, and individual rights, but that tramples freely on those principles abroad." You know, so there's quite a bold critique for an ex-president to be making about American foreign policy.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a reluctance on the part of the president in the novel to cast certain foreign elements in a negative light. It makes the plot very complicated, but I think it's quite an interesting reluctance in him to do that, because it does sort of throw into doubt some of America's activities abroad.
You're right. It interested me who the people that turned up to help him are, who is the Israeli prime minister and a German chancellor. Of course, German chancellor's a former basketball player.
I love that they were all so uber talented in so many different ways, because obviously the president could have been a professional baseball player, bar an injury, you know, sustained while in service.
It's kind of the racehorse logic of meritocracy, isn't it? It's like all of them are sort of exceptionally physical, you know, beings in different
ways.
It's
good bloodstock.
They just happen to be.
As an aside, I thought it was interesting that the UK just didn't figure.
I think the German chancellor looked like German... looked like British royal family, apparently. I think that was his line of description.
There was something in there.
I just wanted to, not wanting to be selfish, I just wanted to read one which I thought was a sort of accidental zinger. It's a very short piece. It's near the end, when he's on the phone to the King of Saudi Arabia. And he says, "Your Highness," I say into the phone, "to King Saad ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, as I sit at my desk in the Oval Office, I raise a mug of coffee to my lips. I don't ordinarily drink coffee in the afternoon, but after 2 hours of sleep and the Friday and Saturday I've just had, ordinary is long gone." It's like, that's a unique window into the world of Bill Clinton, who we can assume from that doesn't drink coffee in the afternoon.
Well, he's very healthy, now that you say it.
I have to say, there is one bit that I was totally taken in by, and I did not see the twist coming. I'm not sure what we're saying about spoilers for our conversation, but if I did not see,
I think we say it's a bit like the news. If you don't want to know the scores of today's results, look away now.
I didn't see
that coming. Oh, you did? Okay, well, you were ahead of me, but I didn't see that twist coming. And actually, what I really did like about that was that it hinged upon spelling. So the reveal was that she knew the correct spelling of the name.
Of the password.
Of the password, which I won't reveal, but that was... you know, actually, as a you know, a grammar Nazi, I enjoyed that.
Okay. Well, there we have it. Strangely, on the cover, it's quite a handsome cover. Mm. Bill Clinton and James Patterson. The president is. You can't really help but reading. The president is missing a novel. Which is actually what it says.
Which is probably more accurate, because the president is not missing for all bar about 15 pages of this novel.
Exactly. So
he's extremely present.
He is very present.
So we've ticked off almost literally "The President is Missing" by Bill Clinton and James Patterson. But on a similar theme, this is the bit where we ask our guests to bring in a little bit of further reading. Ted, you wanted to talk about Behold America, Sarah Churchwell's sort of a history of politics in America and maybe why it is where it's now, because maybe it isn't so different from where it started. Talk us a bit through this one then, Ted.
So this is a history of two phrases which have been opposing and quite defining phrases in the American story of the last century. So it runs from about 1900 to 1940. There is a coda that follows us up to the present, but most of the book is about that period from 1900 to 1940, just after the Second World War. And what it shows is how influential and defining both of these phrases have been in quite opposing and different ways. The American dream wasn't written into the Constitution, but it gained traction as a phrase shortly afterwards. Alexander Hamilton was one of the first to use it in a wide, popular way. And it's fascinating to see Sarah Churchwell is such a brilliant, perceptive and astute, precise writer that she traces the growth and ebb and flow of that phrase and how it took on different meanings at different points. So at some points it meant purely economic liberty and the ability to make your own freedom, your own fortune. But then it took on a slightly more socially aware, perhaps even socialist connotation, where there's a sense of actually it's equality, it's about sharing, caring for our fellow human beings, our fellow Americans, and that version of the American dream had been more in ascendant, but then perhaps it gave way to a sort of free market sense of the American dream again, and that purely economic one. The America First phrase, which has been brought back into life by the current president, she traces this very dark and troubling trajectory of that phrase that was popularized by Woodrow Wilson, but it's essentially always been quite a nativist, racist and exclusionary phrase. I mean, you could argue that at certain points it's meant that America should be leading the way around the world, that it should be outward looking and America should be at the head of the curve. But I think very often it gives way into a sense of racial white supremacy, of America being better than other, that Nordic Americanness was paramount, and that what they call hyphenate Americanism is not real Americanism. So it's a really chilling and gripping history of the way in which those histories collide and shape the present. And actually, as someone, I mean, sure, like both of you, you wake up every day and there's a new story about the Trump presidency. So to have a little bit more historical depth on the sort of language that's surfacing at the moment is actually quite enlightening and sort of frames it in a little bit more of a historical continuum, which, if not exactly consoling, is at least interesting and edifying to know where some of this stuff is coming from, that it's not completely an aberration, that it is actually something, these currents have existed in American life for many decades.
And it's fascinating how, I mean, there is obviously a lot of those two phrases are kind of, I guess, the backbone of the book, but so much is welded onto them. There's so much meat on those bones. It's fascinating. And how a phrase that we kind of, I don't know, my natural reaction to a phrase like that is that it's kind of old fashioned. It's quite nativist.
Yeah.
But you can sort of project anything you want onto something like that is the kind of quality of it. But the strangeness of something that can be taken left, right, up, down, it's a funny one.
It's really interesting because you're right. I mean, the word first doesn't have a sort of pejorative or a nativist connotation. So it can be tilted in all sorts of different directions. It depends who's kind of using it. Woodrow Wilson, interestingly, when he first used that speech in the first year of using it, also used the phrase fake news, which is, I was staggered to learn that. And it was, you know, the same breath almost that America First arrived, fake news arrived. So it went hand in hand with, we're trying to build this kind of unified sense of America, and the news and the press are the people getting in the way of creating that sense of unity. But I think people like Charles Lindbergh, who later used the phrase, the way that it is picked up and run with, I mean, on the lighter side of the, you know, on the more hopeful end of the spectrum with the American dream, when Martin Luther King comes along and starts using that phrase and connecting it with his struggle, that it really revives that phrase in a way that it sort of Fitzgerald had been very precise and accurate in highlighting the way in which the American dream had become a purely economic dream, and that's part of what, and Sarah Churchwell, who better to articulate the ways in which Fitzgerald makes that critique of American economic kind of prosperity.
And the book that she, am I right in saying the book that Sarah Churchwell wrote before this was big pine to...
It was called Careless People, and it's about the writing of The Great Gatsby, and so she's a scholar and an expert on Fitzgerald, on the Fitzgeralds.
It's a fascinating choice. The book is Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream, the phrases of that and all the things that come that flow from that. And that's by Sarah Churchill. Thank you very much, Ted. Sarah, you wanted to talk about the West Wing, where for parts of The President is Missing, we are in, as you say, probably only 30-odd pages. And even then, maybe we're not in the West Wing, who knows. But this is obviously the wonderful... Was it HBO? Was it Showtime? Can't remember where it started. But it was obviously a huge hit in the United States, a huge hit here in the UK.
Yeah.
Power corrupts unless it's Josiah Bartlett, I suppose.
Yeah, so this is... I found it really interesting reading The President is Missing because I kept thinking of similar kind of things that might have happened in The West Wing, and kind of, I think in The President is Missing, you have a president who has, we didn't talk about it, but an illness that he has disclosed to the to the people and is very honest about it. And there's a similar thread that runs through The West Wing, which is a series. It last aired in 2006, so it was seven seasons, and followed a president and mostly his staff, actually. It was never meant to really feature Martin Sheen as the president so much, but he was so good that I think they just wrote a bigger role for him. And it's really one, it's one for people who kind of love the geekiness of American politics, but it's also got great moments of drama and tension. And if you're looking for something that does have thriller-like elements, this really, really does. So you've got kind of West Wing staff wandering around. There's the famous walk and talks that Aaron Sorkin was known for writing.
It changed the way that drama was done, film and TV.
It really did. So these moments of exposition that come when people are walking around the West Wing, which makes them seem less preachy and less patronizing, and I think
makes them always look busy.
It makes them always look busy. They do. I mean, they.
I always do it in the office.
The walk and talk. Now we know. Yeah. Now we know your secret. But one thing I really love about The West Wing is it's never patronizing to its viewer, and you do have to work things out for yourself. And I like that it gives viewers the benefit of thinking they are clever people, and I think that's really important when it comes to fiction of any type, really.
And I suppose you had a president who is very much an ideal, but who had his weaknesses and would sometimes admit them, sometimes was sort of forced to admit them. And I suppose also there was the idea of, although it's thrilling and it's brilliantly written TV and well put together TV, there are moments of kind of the dullness and the sort of like tackiness of working in what is always a slightly understaffed, overpopulated, small bit of a very big famous building as well. There's the kind of minutiae of the crappy coffee cups and the fact that the printer doesn't work. There is a little bit of, I always thought that my favourite bits of The West Wing were almost the bits that were a bit like The Office, where you kind of see the kind of photocopy, you know, you see the dullness of office life somehow.
It's very much of its time in some ways. I mean, in some ways it's very forward thinking, and you watch it now and you think, gosh, how did he predict that things like that would happen when Sorkin was writing? But, you know, there's a whole storyline in the first season that hinges on two people accidentally swapping pages. You know, there's that kind of, it's those sort of little moments that are quite amusing to look back on. And yeah, the minutiae, I think there's a few episodes that are modelled after something that the president in the show calls, or the president's chief of staff calls Big Block of Cheese Day, which is basically when they open the doors of the White House and all the senior staff have to have meetings with all the people that have been writing in about very random things, like creating highways to protect wolves from being run over by cars, or like turning the map the other way up so that, you know, because countries on the bottom of the map are often seen as less well off than countries on the top of the map when you look at it, and all of that kind of stuff. So it is, it's very
got my
much
letter,
a kind
then.
Of yeah, they got your letter.
Yeah.
So it's very much about those kind of things. And then moments of really high tension. There's a couple of really great episodes at the beginning of the second season, where there's been an assassination attempt, and you have all the drama with that. You have kind of kidnappings. So there's lots going on. There's kind of high and low, and I think that's the thing that makes it appealing, is that you kind of get those moments of drama, and then the quieter moments that are perhaps more mundane.
And to bring it full circle, The President Is Missing, I think, has been optioned already not as a movie, but as a TV series. Who is playing President Jonathan Duncan? In our heads, you wanted Harrison Ford.
I mean, it's Harrison Ford for me. Yeah,
who's it for you?
So I kind of feel like this almost already exists in Designated Survivor, which is a Netflix show which has Kiefer Sutherland as the most pure, good-hearted president to ever exist.
Very sort of Nordic-looking president.
So if he wasn't playing that role, I would say someone like that, someone kind of very. Yeah, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, perhaps can grow a red beard as John Duncan can, you know.
He grows that really quickly.
He does. It's pointed out more than once.
That's because he's so damn manly.
Yeah.
Can't help being manly. Thank you so much, Sarah and Ted, for chewing the fat and introducing us to perhaps some slightly better quality further reading as well. But the book is called The President Is Missing. It is by Bill Clinton and James Patterson. It's out now. Take it to the beach, and if in doubt, just use it as a very big kind of parasol. It'll stop you getting sunburned almost all over your body. At 513 pages, it's a whopper. Thank you both very much indeed. That was The Culture Show. It was produced, of course, by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.